When it comes to the challenges that we face, the power that we exercise, and the possibilities that we can imagine, are you as troubled as I am by the performance of the United States over the last several years and the performance of our global society? Let's focus on the U.S. In the United States, Wall Street, the super rich, and the biggest corporations working through both political parties in different ways have distorted and diminished our politics, our courts, our economy, and our aspirations. And the opportunity cost to me of the years, the resources, the lives that we're wasting are way too high. This Sunday, I've invited three people to begin a conversation with me about what's broken at the intersection of our society, our politics, and our economy, how it got broken, and how we can begin to fix it. One of my guests is in the studio. The other two we're trying to get on the phones, but we haven't gotten them yet. So I will introduce the one who is in the studio. RJ Eskow is a former executive and consultant on finance and information technology to AIG, the World Bank, the State Department, among others. He's a prolific and respected blogger at the Huffington Post and Campaign for America's Future. His work is included in the recently released Rough Guide to the Future. Eskow is a columnist for science and culture blog Three Quarks Daily and a contributing editor for Tricycle Magazine. His reflections on blogging and spiritual principles were included in Best Buddhist Writing of 2008. The other two guests, of both of whom we don't have yet, are Rob Johnson and Drew Dellinger. I'll add them to the mix when we get them on the line. RJ.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good.
I have to tell you, I'm phasing out the RJ and going back to my name, Richard. That was when I was consulting and writing radical lefty stuff. Now I'm trying to do the brand shift like SO to Exxon and all that. So please call me Richard. I'm outed now for all history. Yeah.
I have gone through a thing where for the first 12 years, I think, of doing this radio show, I was Terry. And I thought, oh, Terry's more friendly. It's less intimidating. And then I realized, look, I call myself Terrence.
Right.
I'll be Terrence. So it's Richard Eskow. Oh, we have Rob on the phone, so I'm going to bring Rob in as well. This is Rob Johnson. Rob Johnson served as chief economist of the U.S. Senate Banking Committee, was a management director at Soros, and is now the executive director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking, funded by Soros to encourage and support a rethinking of economics so that it pays greater attention to the role of human behavior, including politics. He's also director of the Project on Global Finance at the Roosevelt Institute, and recently served on the United Nations Commission of Experts on International Monetary Reform under the chairmanship of Joseph Stiglitz. But far afield from economics, Johnson was also an executive producer of the Oscar-winning documentary Taxi to the Dark Side on America's use of torture in Iraq and Afghanistan. And he also sprinkled a talk I saw him give this week at the Hammer Museum with an excellent rock soundtrack. Rob Johnson.
Nice to be here.
Okay. Richard Eskow is in the studio with me. You're on the line, and we're still trying to connect with Drew Dellinger. You didn't hear the intro, Rob, but basically I've started at the 10,000-foot view at least, which is just to say that we as a society, I think globally we're disappointing, but I'm focusing this talk at least a little on the United States, and as I saw in your talk the other day, my simple log line for this conversation is money drives politics, politics serves money, it's broke, let's fix it. That there's an intersection here between our politics, our economics, and the money that circulates between the two of them and our society and our culture that I feel is just letting us down terribly when the challenges we face are enormous and the talents and the resources we have are also enormous, but they're not being put together to meet the test. Since I started with Richard, I'm going to let Richard kick off. My first question kind of is, how do you respond to my setup?
Well, I mean, I think you're absolutely right. I think you're, if anything, rather genteel in the way you phrase it. You know, it's been interesting because over the past week, I was thinking about this driving over here, that we've seen two leading economic stories. We've seen rioters in London and throughout Great Britain smashing and looting and burning in order to get flat-screen TVs and other material objects in a nation that offers them no hope. And we've seen wild gyrations in the stock market led by Wall Street and the leading financial institutions there. So I was thinking, here you have one crowd of unrestrained people who will loot and plunder to get what they want, and you have rioters in London. So, you know, we really do have a situation of, you know, unprecedented in modern history, certainly, unrestrained greed and criminality. And we have a situation where it's considered discourteous or impolite to bring that up in political polite company. And I think this creates an enormous problem for us. I think what we really need to be talking now as a generation about are two things. One, how do we air this problem? And two, how do we maintain our morale as people who are sane and right-thinking in an age when it seems like there's no room for that? I think that's the challenge of our day.
So let me see. Those of us who can see and are frustrated maintain our morale. And the first one was just how do we
open the dialogue without appearing to be, without being stereotyped as we so often are, as leftists or radicals or Tea Partiers or window breakers or nothing better than looters ourselves? How do we really say, look, this is a rampage of criminality and greed that needs to be addressed? And how do we do that, make that a part of the mainstream political dialogue when there are so many barriers erected to doing that?
Okay. Rob, your response. To my setup and Richard's take on it.
I think the way you respond, and you saw my chart the other night, that 90% of the population is doing worse over the last 30 years. So if you're trying to organize something called a society, the trickle-down, deregulated, unbridled, do-what-you-will for the very top isn't working for the rest of us. And that's just a fact. You start from that premise, you incorporate the likelihood of social instability in this country, like we just saw in London or we've seen in Spain and Greece this year, and you start talking about what it means to have a society, what it means to have what you might call commons or collective goods, things like libraries and parks that we can all enjoy, including the wealthy, and at some level, recognizing that enforcement of the rules is always important. I think the right makes a big mistake, which is they want to argue for a narrow mandate for government rather than a broad one. But the way they handle it is they try to weaken the civil service. We need a strong civil service, strong and supported, just like the Navy SEALs are, for every task in government, including financial regulation. And then we should have a separate discussion about what is the scope or the breadth of government. What's the mandate that that strong civil service is entrusted with implementing?
Okay. Very good. Drew Dellinger has joined the conversation, so let me tell people. Drew Dellinger is a poet, a teacher, an activist, and the founder of Planetize the Movement. His book of poems, Love Letter to the Milky Way, has readers on six continents. His poems have been cited and quoted in venues ranging from prison workshops to congressional hearings. He studied cosmology and ecological thought with Thomas Berry for 20 years, co-wrote the documentary film The Awakening Universe, and is currently finishing a PhD doctoral dissertation on the last years of Martin Luther King Jr. Drew Dellinger, welcome to the conversation. I have with me in the studio Richard Eskow, and on the phone, Rob Johnson.
Fantastic. Thanks, Terrence. Great to be here with you.
Okay, so the setup that I've asked both of them to respond to is basically just that I'm Richard said I was being too genteel, but I am just profoundly disappointed in how we as a society are responding to the challenges we face and are allowing ourselves to fritter away years and resources and energy and human lives pretending that things are just like they always were, that we are the biggest, the best, and the baddest, and ignoring what's really going on in this country and the cost that might have to our children and the rest of the world. And I asked both of them just to respond to kind of that setup.
Yeah. Well, it's powerful. It's powerful when you lay it out that way, and I certainly think you're right, and I feel your frustration. And I was thinking just the other day that the source of the frustration is that it seems that there is no mechanism, no medium, no format for which we can collectively deal with the challenges that we face. So we live in this state of cultural denial where there's no political mechanism. Washington is gridlocked and controlled by corporations and is looking out for the wealthy, and there's no recognition of the economic challenges we face, of the ecological challenges we face. So we're hurtling towards a climate crisis. We're in the middle of a mass extinction crisis. We continue to have massive poverty, disparity of wealth, social inequality, social injustices, the system of white supremacy that's been in place for the last several centuries continues to function in the educational system, in the media system. So we have systemic racism, we have these other social injustices, and our official leadership is not showing any inclination or even recognition of the depth of these problems or any inclination, to make serious change. So the only alternative I see is building a movement using direct action and civil society. And it's hard to imagine exactly how we're going to turn this ship around, how we're going to build the alternative institutions that we need, but we see inklings, we see glimpses, we see examples of it all over the cultural map. And I think we somehow need to, I know, Terrence, you and I have talked about the power of story, and I know you're interested in narrative, and the work you do is so important. We have to get these stories out. The mindset of the system is always that there is no alternative. So I think, and when we disconnect ourselves from our own history, and we live in a state of perpetual amnesia, so we don't even understand what the labor movement was all about as we're relitigating the same struggles in Wisconsin. We don't understand that the civil rights movement was not, the result of one great charismatic leader, but was the result of hundreds of thousands of actions by ordinary people who stepped up and did extraordinary things. So connecting to the stories of history and how people can make a change and make a difference, as well as connecting to what's happening today and what are those alternatives, what are those ideas that can, create some daylight in this cultural impasse that we're in.
Now that we've gotten sort of what's on the table, I want to double back a bit and ask each of you a little bit about the way you're playing your role in this. And so I'll start with you, Rob, since you, as I said, come from the world of major finance, whether working in the trenches of that world or like with the Senate Banking Committee and so on, and now have started this new organization with the backing of George Soros. What is the Institute for New Economic Thinking? What do you hope to accomplish?
We hope to change the conventional wisdom in 20 years' time. We think that the narrative and the storytelling that emanates from these very technical and mathematical approaches has been intimidating and far off course. We don't consider it scientific to assume that financial markets are stable and then use mathematics to illustrate that, and then create regulatory regimes based on that logic that are completely inadequate, and then watch the world blow up and the financial sector spill all over into everybody else. We hope to inspire people that their responsibility as experts is a responsibility to society. It's a responsibility to look at questions like inequality and suffering, to look at real issues rather than staying in the ivory tower of mathematics and playing with modeling frameworks that may or may not have anything to do with the questions that are dear to us all.
When I said that one of your hopes is that it takes into account more human behavior, including politics and so on, that's a piece of it?
Yes. The idea that this economics and politics don't mix, and that the markets are a mechanical, what you might call a sanitized system that politics can only interfere with, is ridiculous. If you look at the major sectors that are thriving in America, the medical, military, Wall Street, oil, telecom, the key characteristic is they are all attached to the feed bag of the state and very, very active. And it's not a surprise that the most robust real estate market in the major metropolitan areas in Washington, D.C., where all the lobbyists have been an increasing feeding frenzy over the last 30 years.
Okay, and you one thing you said that really struck me is change the way economics is thought in 20 years. So this is a long-term paradigm change, if you will. What has been the response so far, Rob Johnson?
Well, I believe the response has been extraordinarily enthusiastic, both from people at the pinnacle of power and responsibility in government, where they know these models and techniques that you probably all saw in the movie Inside Job led everybody off. I say we made bad maps and we ran the ship onto the reef. You have a lot of people, I would say the majority of economists and political scientists and sociologists are very much at odds with the narrow power orthodoxy that exists around the citadel institutions in the United States, which would be Harvard, MIT, Princeton, and University of Chicago, possibly a little Stanford. But the orthodox economics is quite brittle, and yet people, how would I say, with different views have felt marginalized in their careers. And to create a place where they can get funded, where they can convene, where we include 7 Nobel Prize winners on our board, where people openly express concern that the economics profession is off course, is quite heartening, and we've seen a tremendous reception.
Is this anything, when I was trying to think of what models you might have had in mind, is this anything akin to what the right did starting 30, 40 years ago, and they suddenly said, we've got to start with young people, we've got to seed some new ideas, and if so, one could say they had a long timeline, and to a great extent they succeeded.
Well, I how would I say, their success, particularly in the realm of law and its application to economics, has been a very, very formidable force in the social architecture that we have today. I don't think we've been quite as, deliberate or systematic about ideological conclusions. As you know, George Soros' foundation is called the Open Society Foundation after the work of Karl Popper, who always emphasized in his philosophical work, that an open debate among people that disagree and where fallibilities can be explored and where people can be contradicted is the underpinning of health in a democratic society. So I think rather than an ideological coercion, which I think is part of the right's agenda, we're interested in everybody from the right to the left. I sponsor things at INET at the Milton Friedman Institute at Chicago. I sponsor Friedrich von Hayek scholars, Bruce Caldwell at Duke University is an extraordinary scholar, people at George Mason University, and then people on the very far left as well.
I'm excited by that. So what you're saying is while their agenda may have had answers, what you basically have are questions.
That's right.
Okay.
And it's time to ask a lot of questions because we just shipwrecked the world economy in 2000.
Absolutely. It took, a guest I've had on a few times, Thomas Homer Dixon says, people don't change until they really crash. And to some extent, this is, we really crashed. Let me ask you, Richard Esgow, your approach to how you're personally playing a role in what you're trying to see change.
Well, you go to war with the biography you have, not the biography you wish you had, right? So basically, my story is I was a rock and roll musician and a songwriter and a, kind of wrote for independent papers in Berkeley and all that stuff. And then, all of a sudden I was going to be a dad and life was changing. And I went to work for an HMO and in the early 80s became a software guy and a technology guy. And from there somehow evolved to running a company, working for AIG for a number of years, projecting healthcare costs and financial analyses and acquisitions, and then all based on fear, by the way, which is important to know.
You
when
mean
we're talking
you're doing it or the projections?
My personal career trajectory during those years was based on fear, which I think is an important part of how we speak to people going forward, because everyone is on a track of fear. So I did that for many years, and somehow that evolved into running a group that was a consortium of 20 universities and think tanks doing work with the State Department and the World Bank and USAID and 20, 30 different countries on health sector restructuring, social insurance restructuring. When communism fell in Eastern Europe, we were in all the major Eastern European countries helping them redesign their health system. This was under the first Bush presidency, and Ken Edelman's wife was the project director on our State Department project. So deeply, deeply embedded in that school of thought for a number of years, which was a great personal exercise in being incorporated into a tribal form of thinking, like the kinds of thinking that Rob is describing, and how we are all economic actors, even when we're studying economics and think that we are the sole individuals on earth who are not economic actors. So I did that for a number of years and then went back to straight corporate work. And basically, long story short, couldn't stand it anymore. And it was kind of a worked myself out of a period of midlife crisis and depression. And when John Kerry lost in 2004 and everybody else was depressed, I thought, I don't want to go there. I need to take constructive action. So I began writing and blogging and doing all this stuff. And somehow, oddly and absurdly enough, that that turned into a career. Kierkegaard says life can only be lived forward, but it can only be understood backward. And so somehow that developed into a trajectory of some sort. And so I would say for the last 6 or 7 years, basically what I've done is look at, my academic work was mostly social sciences, some economics, a lot of sociology, a lot of quantifiable stuff. I guess I would say I've tried to blend the storytelling with the quantitative to the greatest extent possible. I mean, you know, for a 17-year-old who was playing, opening for the New York Dolls at CBGB's, to then say, it's kind of like, how do you synthesize and really communicate a narrative and of something different, of different possibilities? So that's really what I've been about. And, also trying to see, as a kind of traditional moorings of faith and society and trust and values have come unhinged. You know, one of the ironies of the 70s was that the right kept accusing the left of being moral relativists. They remember the moral relativism argument, but they're the absolute moral relativists. So how you kind of create new ground for people to stand on in order to distinguish right from wrong and, find battles worth fighting when everybody's talking in terms of compromise and trend, and they're only comparing today to tomorrow and yesterday and not to some standards of what's right and what's wrong. I mean, that somehow has gotten under my skin and become a recurrent theme. So I guess I would say the two recurrent themes are, first of all, to look at all of this as a anthropological problem in one way that, when Rob was talking about the economists, I'm always looking at the economic and the political community. I'm always using the phrase in my writing, what would anthropologists of the future say about this if we survive and have anthropologists, which I hope we will? How will they come back and look at the Washington mania and groupthink for cutting Social Security and or any of these other odd ideas? What is this sort of folkways at work? What is the culture at here? Because it can't be understood in purely rational manners. And in what way is the economic thinking that Rob was describing really a new theology? Because that is how I think of it. These are articles of faith that the free market works so that when the free market explodes around you and leaves the world in smoldering ruins, you still believe the free market works. Other forms of faith can't be disproved. This is a theology that can be disproved, but people cling to it anyway. So, and there are economic reasons for it and other reasons, but that's, I guess, as much as I can tell you, that's my mission.
That's great. And what's interesting is that both of you have talked, all three of you have talked about story, all three of you have talked about narrative, and all three of you have been are describing your own work. I'm going to get to you in a second, Drew, but as actually encompassing a view of the pragmatic and the practical and so on, but also looking very much upstream, looking for root problems, root answers, rather than getting lost in the American mania on symptoms and so on. And it's interesting when you were just saying that, Richard, about how you look on economics and politics and their conversations as almost being like articles of faith. It reminds me of what Andrew Bacevich says about foreign policy and the military. He makes it in his Washington Rules. Those are his two big things. There's a credo, it's faith that they go on. So when their wars fail, they return to their faith. When the economics crashes, they return to their faith. Drew Dellinger, your personal, how you are personally playing your role and defining your role in this situation.
Sure. Well, I'm a speaker and a poet and a teacher and a writer, so I use education and the arts as a form of, you know, awareness raising and activism. So arts activism is one thing that I've been interested in terms of spoken word poetry, particularly in my example, because I think the power of the arts is it hits people at the level of the heart and the soul, and that's where change can take place. And the way I got into what I am doing, it was fascinating to listen to Rob and Richard and to hear some resonances in my own story. But when I was starting college around, 19, 20 years old, I came across the work of Thomas Berry, particularly a book called The Dream of the Earth. And he was talking about cosmology, which is a big word that basically means the story that a culture tells itself about how the universe came to be and how we fit into it. So Berry was really talking about the power of story. And he was saying the reason why our Western civilization is dysfunctional and is heading toward ecological catastrophe is because we've had a dysfunctional story. We've had a story that humans are separate from nature, that we're superior to nature, that we walk around on top of nature, and that we can treat nature any way we choose. Humans have all the value and all the rights, and nature has no value and no rights. And in addition to that, we have these other stories that have developed, such as the myth of progress. And the myth of progress is this kind of mythic entrancement that Thomas Berry says has seized the modern world. Much like Richard was saying, Berry would say that the evidence that this myth of progress, and so the myth is that we're going to create a wonder world, that we can create a perfect world. We're not going to get hot in the summer. We're not going to get cold in the winter. We can cut down all the trees and pave over the continents and create a wonder world. But the reality is that we're creating a waste world. The reality is that we're destroying the only environment, that is planet Earth, in which humans can flourish and function and in which we arose. And so, but this mythic entrancement is so intense that Thomas Berry says, even as the evidence is stacking up all around us that we're heading towards catastrophe, we continue to be locked in this mythic entrancement. And so that's, and so when Thomas Berry was saying that economics is, it's a visionary commitment, grounded in myth. And I began to see, wow, the whole modern world is based on paradigms and narratives and mythic structures. And so what Thomas Berry briefly was saying is that we need to reintegrate into the story of the universe itself, that the universe is an unfolding reality that has given birth to 100 billion galaxies, that has given rise to planets such as ours, that gave rise to ocean and atmosphere and animals and human beings and consciousness throughout the whole process. And now here we are. And how are we going to celebrate and make a creative contribution to the unfolding cosmic and planetary story that we're a part of? And I think that cosmological perspective gives us a basis from which to evaluate, much the same way Richard was talking about projecting oneself into the consciousness of a future anthropologist and then, analyzing how ludicrous the drama in Washington, D.C. is. I think in a similar way, stepping out and taking a galactic cosmological perspective can make us see that, wow, maybe we aren't here to racially discriminate and fight violent wars against each other and to exploit and oppress each other. Maybe we're here to be part of this communion and celebration that is the unfolding planet Earth. And so I think the cosmological perspective can give us a perspective for evaluating economics war, racism, sexism, etc. And so just to wrap up, part of my journey has been in taking this kind of cosmological, ecological perspective from Thomas Berry and integrating it with my lifelong interests in social justice, anti-racism work, human rights. So I have seen myself as using arts and writing and my work as an academic and as a teacher to explore the intersections of ecology and social justice.
Very good. That's Drew Dellinger. We're at the halfway point. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking today with Richard Esgow, Drew Dellinger, and Rob Johnson about the money, politics, and the economy, the intersection, and by the choice of my three guests for this conversation, we have gone, I started at 10,000 feet. We've gone up to 50,000 at least a couple of times. To learn more about any of their work, you can go to drewdellinger.org. Or for Richard Esgow, you can go to ourfuture.org or huffingtonpost.com. And for Rob Johnson, who is the director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking, you can go to INET Economics, I-N-E-T, economics, one word, .org. I often like to do these interviews with four big questions. How is it broken? How did it get broken? How do we fix it? And what stories do we need to tell? I don't think I'm going to deal with how it's broken. We know that. And I would ask only if any of you, want to, you think there's a striking point that people may have missed or may need to hear about how it happened that sheds particular light on how we deal with the current moment. I'm open to that. Anybody?
I'll say one thing briefly.
That's Drew, right?
Yeah, sorry, this is Drew. I mean, I think we need to really look at the rise of corporate power and to look at, you know, and this came to the forefront just a couple of days ago with Mitt Romney, you know, kind of gleefully declaring that corporations are people. And of course, you know, legally, it's been held that they are. But this goes back to a Supreme Court decision in 1886, the Santa Clara Railroad decision, which many legal scholars will tell you that corporate personhood is not even contained in that decision, but merely in the way that decision was interpreted later. So I think we need to look at the rise of, you know, and Abraham Lincoln was concerned. He didn't see that there were going to be any effective checks on corporate power. So I think we need to look at the rise of corporate power and to understand that because we live in this amnesiac culture, we don't understand that some of these things came about in a certain way and can therefore be changed. They aren't immutable. And in a similar way, I don't think we understand how racism developed on the North American continent through, you know, and how the idea of race and racial oppression was in many ways invented through the Virginia slave codes of the 1700s. And then those Virginia slave codes were adopted by all of the other 13 colonies. So I think we don't understand the ways in which racism is created and the ways in which race has been constructed. And I think if we knew some of that history, that then we could dismantle some of the structures of racism that we have in our culture.
Okay. Well, Richard.
For me, it's a matter. Certainly, I agree with everything Drew said, historically speaking. But I think it's a matter of clinging to the narrative that says throughout history, injustice has fallen and invincible regimes have fallen and over and over and over again. So to me, you know, I wrote a piece for the 4th of July called Declaring Independence from Corporate Politics, but also Mental Independence. Emancipate yourself from mental slavery, as Bob Marley would say. The idea that stop relying on a politician, stop relying on a party, stop relying on a leader, build those lateral communities, the kind that Drew was talking about. But in terms of story and narrative, first and foremost, remember the narratives of success. A cop slaps a shopkeeper in Tunisia, and the Arab world changes. Nelson Mandela sits hopelessly in jail for 26 years, and on the 27th is released, and the next year becomes president. Over and over, Gandhi, you know. So the narratives of surprise success when you least expect it, thinking long term, but also knowing that it could happen in your lifetime. It could happen next year. It could happen next week. We don't know, but, you know, that sort of keep the faith, persevere, keep a candle burning in the window story. I think it's one we have to keep telling ourselves over and over.
You know, I'm going to ask you now, Rob Johnson, but I'm going to mention first that I saw you this past week. You spoke at the Hammer Museum, and it was you and Andy Stern, the former and longtime head of the Service Employees International, SEIU. And what Richard was just saying about, you know, things change when we least expect it seemed to be the mantra that Andy Stern found himself repeating over and over again. You know, this is a revolutionary moment, he said, and we don't know what's going to happen or how it's going to happen. Rob Johnson.
One has to puncture lots of myths about the adequacy of individual achievement for a satisfactory life. One has to go at this notion that if I just keep my head down or if I just keep kissing up to the corporation or whatever, that somehow I'm going to feel good and be satisfied in the end. I think the questions that Richard was just addressing are very, very important, but it's a double-edged sword. On the one level, be aware, be hopeful, keep your strength for change. But on another level, I expected after Ronald Reagan that the pendulum would swing back to the middle. And it's kept going and going and going and going for very systemic reasons having to do with this money in politics. For another, let's see, he got out of office in 1988, so we're talking 23 years, and it's still going in the wrong direction. So I don't think we can take any solace from the idea that there's revolutionary potential in the air. These changes have to be realized from the acts of will of a collective experience of the American people.
Okay, I so much agree, and I must say I echo that feeling. I remember when Reagan was over, it was like, oh boy, you know, and yet, as you say, not only has it continued, but I would say it is at its worst. And if you look at Winner Take All Politics by Hacker and Pearson, and if you look at The Spirit Level, the book by Pickett and Dickinson, I believe.
Wilkinson. Yeah,
what? Wilkinson. Yeah. Spirit Level is a book. I've had them on here and I've talked about it a lot, but it's one that I hope gets more around. What they found in The Spirit Level is that countries with the greatest inequality work worst for everyone. And it's not just they work worst for everyone in terms of economics. They work worst for everyone in terms of health, mental health. And the one that I found even more surprising was innovation, that the number of patents per capita actually goes down with when inequality goes up. And I think that is, I mean, if when I think about the biggest things we face right now, inequality strikes me as way up there. And then the other thing is the corporate dominance. Let's shift now to how.
Can I add one thought, Terrence?
Yeah, absolutely.
I just want to mention, because we were talking about, you know, after the Reagan years, the expectation that the pendulum would swing back, and I remember being impressed by the thesis of a book by Charles Durber called Hidden Power, where he said, you know, in the 1980, the Reagan inauguration was the beginning of a regime change, and it was the beginning of kind of the end of the New Deal period and the beginning of a corporate regime. And so when Bill Clinton came into power, came into office, I should say, in 1992, we had a Democrat instead of a Republican in the White House, but we didn't have any regime change in terms of the corporate regime that solidified power in 1980. So I think what we see now and what the panel's speaking to is that, you know, just getting a Democrat in the White House is not regime change from the corporate political structure that we have.
Okay, Richard Eskow.
Well, I agree with both those statements, and I think that, you know, one of the debates I've been having with friends is whether the last couple years has felt more like Invasion of the Body Snatchers or Invaders from Mars, but the sense that seemingly benevolent forces can represent the same underlying entity. I think that's very much what we're seeing now. So I guess the two reactions I would have, and especially to Rob, who made a couple of great points. One is, you know, my own story is one of that track of personal satisfaction proving not only unfulfilling, but ultimately self-destructive, that we have to start pursuing a collective path of satisfaction, I think is really important. And I think that, yes, we need to be aware that Reagan was a shift in direction rather than a temporary blip. We were placing too much faith in temporal politics, you know, brief political changes of party, but that means that, you know, we've got to be prepared to fight as if we can win at any moment, but prepared to hang in for the long term. You know, Dalai Lama was asked what he thought of the French Revolution, and he said it's too early to tell. You know, so we have to be willing to hang in, but at the same time, fight as if it matters what happens today, because it really does matter what happens today.
Okay, let me just share a couple of the ways I see things right now. This is Terrence McNally. One is that, and it speaks to what you were just saying, how Clinton didn't break that regime, and Obama clearly has not, is that more and more, and I trace it to when television advertising became the medium of political campaigns. The people may say, oh, that the big problem with that is it meant short attention spans were what it was about. No, the big problem with that is that it's expensive.
Right.
And once they took a leap, and I think this is probably, we remember one commercial from the Johnson campaign, the Daisy commercial, but I don't think it was quite then. I think it began over the next few years where campaigns became so expensive that money became everything. And that what I see is that the Democrats and the Republicans are funded by the same entities, super rich and big corporations for the most part, or at least those are the ones that they feel they owe something to, because a lot of small donations is not someone you have to reckon with as much. And that what you have is a Republican Party that goes for touchdowns because their principles are in sync with their funders. And what you have with Democrats is a party who is constantly negotiating with themselves, because if they have principles, they are not in keeping with their funders. And so what you have is a Republican Party going for a touchdown, a Democratic Party going for maybe the 20-yard line, and A, you don't get real solutions, and B, you do not get respect. Americans respect people who go for it, who have boldness, who have conviction, and so you lose in both senses. Does that picture seem true to people, and how do we break that one?
Well, I think Richard. This is Richard. I think there's no question that there's a great deal of truth to it, an enormous amount of truth to it. And I think what it's led to is a Republican Party that is absolutely full-throated in its support of the financial interests. And I think increasingly a Democratic Party that sees itself as almost a Mandarin class. I've been working on writing something about this. I haven't been able to finish it. A kind of Confucian party that says the best thing we can do is be wise and noble and well-educated servants of the emperor, with the emperor being, you know, Wall Street and corporate interests, as opposed to the other guys who are kind of brutal, barbarian servants of the emperor. But I think we really need to be able to say we have to attack the very institutions that are creating this situation, and that's the way we fund our elections, that's the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, that's Wall Street, that if we don't go directly, and by attacking them, I don't obviously mean totally nonviolently with light rather than heat, but if we don't address those issues, then we're going to continue to have the Confucian Democrats with a wiser, gentler dismantling of the social contract, or the radically brutal Republican. Right, but it will be the same outcome.
Yeah, so. Exactly. Rob?
I think there are two things going on here. The first of which you cited, which is the cost of elections. And I would turn everybody on to the book by Thomas Ferguson and Joel Rogers called Right Turn, which is about the formation of the Democratic Leadership Council and the what you might call struggle for survival in the monetary realm. But we have two currencies in electoral politics, money and votes. And the relative importance of money, for the reasons you cited on television, have gone way up. Second dimension, the alignment between the interests of American people and corporate and financial leaders has broken down with globalization. American corporations no longer need a healthy or well-educated American workforce, for the most part, because their plants are located in low-cost parts of Asia and Latin America. And so reconciling the notion of a society with the notion of a corporate executive being a member of society but responsible to stockholders who are making their money overseas is creating all kinds of contradictions. And as long as money is large in relation to votes, the contradictions are going to be resolved in favor of those stockholders and those corporate managements and those financial firms.
Thank you, Rob, because I hadn't put it together that you're right, that what was shifting toward the corporations having more power wasn't quite so critically negative until globalization, where they no longer need an American middle class. In Reagan's time, there still was some value in an American middle class. I'm going to throw one other one out there to all of you, because actually you did it the other day. During your talk the other day, or in one of your answers to a question, Rob Johnson, you said, how is it that Americans can't see and adopt and value good ideas from other countries? And this is something which I've been returning to repeatedly, whether it was talking about Stephen Hill's book, The European Promise, or Tom Gagin's book, Were You Born on the Wrong Continent? But that Germany made very different choices than we did after World War II and then again at the period of globalization, and they decided they would remain a quality manufacturing company that took care of its people even while competing excellently in the global marketplace. And that question that you said, you turned to the moderator and Andy Stern and said, guys, what's going on with that? And both of them deferred to answer. But to me, that one is a big one, because when I look for ways we can begin to move, it's to say, I put it this way, America prides itself on being the can-do country, right? The can-do culture. Well, the can-do culture doesn't mean you invent everything. A can-do culture means you see what someone does, you adapt it, you shape it, you improve it, and you work it. And somehow we, our American exceptionalism gets in the way of our can-do-ness in a way which to me looks pathological.
You talked about puncturing myths. And the two myths that always cross my mind is the myth of Darwinistic evolution through ideas, and obviously the imitation of the better mousetrap would be the implication of that, and we don't do that. The Chinese right now are investing in education, infrastructure, science research, and we're here cutting our government, our state back, while they're building theirs up, and we're afraid that they're outcompeting us. Those are not reconcilable notions. The second myth is the myth of Horatio Alger. You put your head down, you work hard, and you can control your own fate. Everybody's afraid. The idea you can control your own fate is a very attractive mirage. But when you don't control the freedom of large Wall Street firms, they can blow you out of your house, even though you get up and you work hard and you take continuing education and you do everything right as a good citizen, because somebody in another sector didn't have proper boundaries around them, because we conflated freedom of an individual to pursue their well-being with the freedom of large corporations to do whatever they want, regardless of the side effects.
Richard wants to jump in. Rob Johnson.
I would say I definitely agree with that, and I think that goes back to the stories we tell ourselves and the deep disagreement I've had with a movie, for example, like The Pursuit of Happiness with Will Smith, where he just takes a chance and escapes from a cycle of poverty by gambling everything on the stock market. That's based on a true story, but for every guy like that, there are a half a million who ruined their lives with that kind of dream and fantasy of escapism, or athletes or entertainers or others. These are, or America's top idol or whatever. These are the stories we tell ourselves to deny the collective reality of where we live. And going back to Germany, just real briefly, I think one of the reasons why they did what they did was because they set a mission for themselves nationally. Probably partially because the Weimar Republic was still very much in living memory, and they know what happens when an economy collapses. But they said their mission statement, in effect, whether they articulated it this way, was how do we maintain a strong and vibrant middle class and a strong social contract and then move out into the global economy? We don't do that. So I think that's one of the huge differences.
Yeah, one of the points there is that Germany says not we're competing, or basically what I say is we shouldn't be competing, think we're competing with China. We should be competing with Germany to sell to China. And instead, we have opted the other way. We've got basically 3 minutes. I'm going to give you each 1 minute. And sort of what's the number one, like, first step that begins to turn this ship around? Drew Dellinger.
I think we need to recognize, you know, the collective power that we have. And I think we need to tell stories based on a sense of that collective power. And exactly like Richard and Rob were saying, you know, there are these moments in history. There are these moments when, as Dr. King said, when time itself is ready for a change. There comes a time when time itself is ready for a change. And I think we need to take control of our own narratives and our own stories in a way that rivals the corporate media. And I'm not sure how we do that, but we have to keep building with the kind of media personalities like you are, Terrence. And I think that was the one thing that when you talked about the importance of money in politics, I think, and with the television advertising, I think you were absolutely right. And that corresponded with a decline in real journalism in our
exactly.
country.
Exactly. Exactly. Let me ask you, Rob Johnson, first steps.
First step. Is recognize that these deterioration in conditions over the last 30 years is not a coincidence. Identifying the obstacles to healthy change. All of us can come up with a whole myriad of constructive policies. All of us are dumbfounded as to how to bring them about. We've got to get money out of politics or we're not even at the starting line.
Okay. Richard Eskow.
Well, you know, William Blake, you know, in every voice, in every band, the mind-forged manacles I hear. To break these mind-forged manacles and say that real change is absolutely possible, I would echo these two guys. And to remember that an unjust economic system is inherently unstable. It can't last forever. So it's our work to keep alive and make sure that when it collapses, something better replaces it rather than something worse.
Okay. Again, my guests have been Rob Johnson, Executive Director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking, Drew Dellinger, founder of Planetize the Movement, and Richard Eskow, who blogs at Huffington Post and Campaign for America's Future. To learn more about Drew, go to drewdellinger.org. For Richard Eskow, ourfuture.org or HuffingtonPost.com. And for Rob Johnson, the Institute for New Economic Thinking, which is INET, I-N-E-T, economics. One word, ineteconomics.org. You can listen to this week's conversation and many others anytime during the week by linking to our podcast. You can sign up to have it delivered to you weekly. For podcasts, articles, transcripts of interviews, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net. TerrenceMcNally, TerrenceMcNally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're both the same website. And if you want to receive my weekly email announcement of upcoming guests and issues, sign up either at my site or by emailing me at TEMcNally@mac.com. Finally, thank you to Drew Dellinger, Rob Johnson, and Richard Eskow. Keep up your good work.